Osho, the Heart Sutra, talks on Prajnaparamita Vidyayam Sutra of Gautama the Buddha, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 5.
Bhagwan. Therefore, O Sariputra, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no perception, no impulse, no consciousness. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. No forms, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or objects of mind. No sight, organ, element, and so forth until we come to no mind consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so forth until we come to there is no decay and death, no extinction of decay and death. There is no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path. There is no cognition, no attainment, and no non-attainment.
Nothingness is the fragrance of the beyond. It is the opening of the heart to the transcendental. It is the unfoldment of the 1,000-petaled lotus. It is man's destiny. Man is complete only when he has come to this fragrance, when he has come to this absolute nothingness inside his being, when this nothingness has spread all over him, when he is just a pure sky, unclouded. This nothingness is what Buddha calls nirvana. First, we have to understand what this nothingness actually is, because it is not just empty. It is full. It is overflowing. Never for a single moment think that nothingness is a negative state, an absence. No. Nothingness is simply no thingness. Things disappear. Only the ultimate substance remains. Forms disappear. Only the formless remains. Definitions disappear, the undefined remains. So nothingness is not as if there is nothing. It simply means there is no possibility of defining what is there. It is like you remove all the furniture from your house outside. Somebody comes in and he says, now here is nothing. He has seen the furniture before. Now the furniture is missing and he says, here there is no more anything. Nothing is. His statement is valid only to a certain extent. In fact, when you remove the furniture, you simply remove obstructions in the space of the house. Now pure space exists. Now nothing obstructs. Now there is no cloud roaming in the sky. It is just a sky. It is not just nothing. It is purity. It is not only absence, it is a presence. Have you ever been in an absolutely empty house? And you will find that emptiness as a presence. It is very tangible. You can almost touch it. That's the beauty of a temple, or a church, or a mosque. Pure nothing. Just empty. When you go into a temple, what surrounds you is nothingness. It is empty of everything, but not just empty. In that emptiness, something is present, but only present for those who can feel it, who are sensitive enough to feel it, who are aware enough to see it. Those who can see only things will say, "What is there? Nothing." Those who can see nothing will say, "All is here," because nothing is here. The identity of yes and no is the secret of nothingness. Let me repeat it. It is very basic to Buddha's approach. Nothingness is not identical with no. Nothingness is the identity of yes and no, where polarities are no more polarities, where opposites are no more opposites. When you make love to a woman or to a man, the point of orgasm is the point of nothingness. At that moment, the woman is no more a woman, and the man is no more a man. Those forms have disappeared. That polarity between man and woman is no more there. That tension is no more there. It is utterly relaxed. They both have melted into each other. They have unformed themselves. They have gone into a state which cannot be defined. The man cannot say I, the woman cannot say I. They are no more I's. They are no more egos. Because egos are always in conflict. The ego exists through conflict. It cannot exist without conflict. In the moment of orgasm, there are no more any egos. Hence the beauty of it. Hence the ecstasy of it. Hence the samadhi-like quality of it. But it happens only for a moment. But even that moment, a single moment of it is more valuable than your whole life. Because in that moment you come closest to the truth. Man and woman are no more separate. This is a polarity. Yin and yang, positive and negative, day and night, summer and winter, life and death. These are polarities. When yes and no meet, when the opposites meet and are no more opposites, when they go into each other and dissolve into each other, there is orgasm. Orgasm is the meeting of yes and no. It is not identical with no. It is beyond both yes and no. In a sense, it is beyond both. In a sense, it is both. Together. Simultaneously, the merger of the negative and the positive is the definition of nothingness. And that is the definition of orgasm too. And that is the definition of samadhi too. Let it be remembered. The identity of yes and no is the secret of emptiness, nothingness, nirvana. Emptiness is not just empty. It is a presence, very solid presence. It does not exclude its opposite. It includes it. It is full of it. It is a full emptiness. It is an overflowing emptiness. It is alive, abundantly alive, tremendously alive. So never for a single moment let dictionaries deceive you. Otherwise you will misunderstand Buddha. If you go to the dictionary and look for the meaning of nothingness, you will miss Buddha. The dictionary only defines the ordinary nothingness, the ordinary emptiness. Buddha is talking about something very extraordinary. If you want to know it, you will have to go into life, into some situation where yes and no meet. Then you will know it. Where the body and the soul meet. When the world and the God meet. Where opposites are no more opposites. Only then you will have a taste of it. The taste of it is the taste of Tao, of Zen, of Hasidism, of yoga. The word yoga is also meaningful. It means coming together. When a man and a woman meet, it is a yoga. They come together. They really come close. They start overlapping and then they disappear into each other. Then they don't have centers anymore. The conflict of the opposites has disappeared. And there is utter relaxation. This relaxation happens only momentarily between a man and a woman. But this relaxation can happen with the total, with the whole, in a non-temporal way. It can happen in an eternal way. In love, you have only a drop of ecstasy. In ecstasy, you have the whole ocean of love. This nothingness can be achieved only if there are no thought clouds in you. Those are the clouds that are hampering your inner space, obstructing your inner space. Have you watched the sky? In summer, it is so clean and clear, so crystal clear. Not a speck of a cloud. And then comes the rains and thousands of clouds come and the whole earth is surrounded with clouds. The sun disappears. The sky is no more available. This is the state of the mind. The mind is constantly clouded. It is the rainy season of your consciousness. The sun is no more available. The light is hidden, hindered. And the purity of his space and the freedom of his space is no more available. Everywhere you find yourself defined by the clouds. When you say, I am a Hindu, what are you saying? You are getting caught by a cloud, the thought that you are a Hindu. When you say, I am a Mohammedan or a Christian or a Jain, what are you saying? You are becoming identified with a thought cloud. You are losing your purity. That's why I say a religious man is neither Hindu nor Mohammedan nor Christian. He cannot be. He is a summer time of consciousness. He has no clouds. The sun is there bright, unhindered. And there is infinite space around him. There is silence around him. You will not find the vibe of the cloudy consciousness. When you say, I am a communist, what are you saying? You are saying that you have been reading Karl Marx, Lenin, Stalin, Mao, that you have become too much attached with Das Kapital, that you have become identified with the idea of class struggle, the poor and the rich and the conflict, that you have become too much attracted, hypnotized by a dream, an utopia, that someday in future a classless society can be created, that you have become too much obsessed with this utopia and you are ready to do anything for it. Even if you have to kill millions of people, you are ready for their own sake, for their own good. This is a cloudy state. When you say, I am an Indian, again the same. When you say, I am a Chinese, again the same. If you really want to be religious, you will have to drop these identities slowly, slowly. No idea should ever possess you. No book should be your Bible. No Veda should define you. No Gita should confine you. You should not allow any philosophy, theology, dogma, theory, hypothesis to overcrowd you. You should not allow any smoke around your flame of consciousness. Only then you are religious. If you ask a religious man who you are, he can only say, I am a nothingness. Because nothingness is not an idea. It is not a theory. It simply indicates a state of purity. Remember, perception has nothing to do with knowledge. In fact, when you perceive through knowledge, you don't perceive rightly. All knowledge creates projections. Knowledge is a bias. Knowledge is a prejudice. Knowledge is conclusion. You have concluded even before you have gone into it. For example, if you come to me with a conclusion already in your mind, it may be for me, it may be against me, that doesn't matter. If you come to me with a conclusion, then you come with a cloud. Then you will go on looking at me through your clouds, and naturally your clouds will throw shadows on me. If you have come with the idea that this is the right man, then you will find something which goes on supporting your idea. If you have come with the idea that this is a wrong man, dangerous, evil, then you will go on finding something which supports your idea. Whatsoever idea you bring, it is self-perpetuating. It goes on finding proofs for itself. And the man who has come with a prejudice will go with his prejudice strengthened. In fact, he had never come to me. To come to me needs to be unclouded, with no prejudice, far or against, with no a priori. You just come to see what is there. You don't bring any opinion. You have heard many things, but you don't believe any. You simply come to see by your own eyes. You come to feel by your own heart. That is the quality of a religious man. And if you want to know truth, you will have to drop all kinds of knowledges that you have gathered down the ages in many, many lives. Whenever somebody comes to truth with knowledge, he cannot see it. He is blind. Knowledge blinds you. If you want to be clear eyes, drop knowledge. Perception has nothing to do with knowledge. Truth and knowledge don't go together. Knowledge cannot contain the immensity of life and existence. Knowledge is so tiny, so small. And existence is so vast, so enormous. How it can contain existence? It cannot. And if you force existence into your patterns of knowledge, you will destroy the beauty of it, and you will destroy the truth of it. Once existence is converted into knowledge, it is no more existence. It is as if a person is carrying a map of India and thinks that he is carrying India. No map can contain India. The picture of the moon is not the moon. The word God is not God. The word love is not love either. No word can contain the mysteries of life. And knowledge is nothing but words and words and words. Knowledge is a great illusion. That's why Buddha says, allow nothingness to settle in you. Nothingness means a state of not knowing. A state where no cloud floats into your consciousness. When your consciousness is unclouded, then you are nothing. Nothing goes perfectly well with truth. Only nothing goes perfectly well with truth. Knowledge cannot contain the mystery of being. Knowledge is against the mysterious. The mysterious means that which is not known, that which cannot be known, that which is basically, intrinsically, essentially unknowable. Not only unknown, but unknowable. How the unknowable can be reduced to knowledge? Knowledge goes on collecting pebbles on the shore and goes on missing the diamonds. Knowledge is mediocre, borrowed, never authentic, never original. To know truth, you need an insight, original insight. You need eyes which can see through and through. You need transparent vision. So only when the mind is entirely naked of knowledge, empty of knowledge, it comes to know. When there is no knowledge, there is knowledge. Because when there is no knowledge, there is knowing. When the mind is entirely naked of knowledge, nude, silent, non-functioning, when the mind is in waiting, with no idea for what, just a pure waiting, expectant but not knowing for what, waiting for the guest but with no idea, waiting for the knock of the guest with the open door but with no idea who this guest is. How can you know it beforehand? If you carry a blueprint for God, you will go on missing God because you have not known him before. Yes, others have known, but whatsoever they have said are only maps. I can give you only a map. All knowledge is a map. Don't start worshipping the map. Don't start creating a temple around the map. That's how temples have been created. One temple is devoted to Vedas, another to Bible, another to Quran. These are maps. These are not the real country. They are only charts. When I say something to you, I have to use words. Words reach you. You jump upon the words. You start holding the words. The mind is a great holder. And then you start thinking that you know. This is not the way to know. The way to know is to discard all knowledge. And discard it in a single blow. Don't go slowly, gradually. If you see the point, it can happen in this very moment. In fact, to see the point is to let it happen. You need not do anything in particular. You need not even drop knowledge. Just seeing the point that knowledge cannot make you a knower. In fact, it will hinder you. Seeing this, the revolution. Seeing this, the transformation. So when the mind is naked, is silent, is non-functioning, is in utter waiting, then there comes truth. Then there is truth. It need not come from anywhere. It has been always there. But you were so full of knowledge, hence you went on missing it. Nothingness can know truth, because in nothingness intelligence functions totally. Only in nothingness intelligence functions totally. That's why you see the miracle. Children are so intelligent and old people by and by become so dull. Children learn things so fast. The older you become, the more difficult it becomes to learn. If you are old and you want to learn Chinese, you will take 30 years. And a child learns within 2-3 years. Now scientists say that a child can learn at least 4 languages very easily if he is just exposed to 4 languages very easily. This is the minimum. Maximum has not been yet decided. How many languages a child can learn together if he is exposed? It happens if the family is multilingual, it happens very easily. If the town is multilingual, it happens very easily. In Bombay, it happens easily. The child will learn Hindi, English, Marathi, Gujarati, very easily. The child needs only to be exposed. He is so intelligent. that he immediately sees the point of it and learns it. The older you become, the more difficult. It is very difficult, they say, to teach an old dog new tricks. It need not be so. If you remain a nothingness, then it need not be so, because then you remain a child your whole life. Socrates is a child even when he is dying, because he is still vulnerable, open, ready to learn even from death. When he is lying on the bed and the poison is being prepared, at 6 o'clock he will be given the poison as the sun will be setting. And he is so excited, like a child. His disciples are crying and weeping. And he is so excited, he gets up again and again and goes out to inquire the man who is preparing the poison, how long it will take. His eyes are so curious. And the man is going to die. This is no time to be so curious. And the man is going to have his last breath within minutes. And he's so excited, so ecstatic. And one disciple asks, "For what you are getting so excited? You are going to die." And Socrates says, "Life I have known, and I have learned much from life. Now I would like to know death and learn from death. That's why I'm excited." Even death becomes a great experience to one who is innocent. Socrates is innocent. The West has not produced another man comparable to Socrates. Socrates is the Buddha of the West. You can remain always capable of learning if you remain a child. What creates in you dullness, stupidity, mediocrity? Knowledge. You accumulate knowledge, you become less and less capable of knowing. Renounce knowledge. I teach you renunciation of knowledge. I don't teach you renunciation of the world. That is stupid, foolish, meaningless. I teach you renunciation of knowledge. And a strange thing happens. I have come across people who have renounced the world. In the Himalayas, I met a Hindu fakir, very old, must be 90 years or even more. For 70 years he has been a sannyasin. For 70 years he has lived outside society. He has renounced society. He has not been back to the plains for 70 years. When he was just a young man of 20, he went to the Himalayas and he has not come back to the country again. He has never been again in a crowd. But he is still a Hindu. He still thinks of himself as a Hindu. I told him that you renounce society, but you have not renounced your knowledge, and the knowledge was given by the society. You are still a Hindu. You are still in the crowd, because to be a Hindu is to be in a crowd. You are still not an individual. You have not become a nothing yet. The old man understood. He started crying. He said, "Nobody said this to me." You can renounce the society, you can renounce wealth, you can renounce the wife, the children, the husband, the family, the parents. Easy. Nothing much in it. The real thing is to renounce knowledge. These things are outside you. You can escape from them. But where and how you will escape from something that is inside you, that is clinging there, that will go with you. You can go to a Himalayan cave and you remain a Hindu, you remain a Mohammedan, you remain a Christian. Then you will not be able to see the beauty and truth of the Himalayas, that virginity of the Himalayas. You will not be able to see. A Hindu cannot see it. A Hindu is blind. To be a Hindu means to be a blind. To be a Mohammedan means to be a blind. You may use different instruments to become blind. That doesn't matter. One is blind because of the Quran, another is blind because of Bhagavad Gita, and somebody else is blind because of the Bible. But eyes are full of knowledge. Buddha says, nothingness allows intelligence to function. The word Buddha comes from buddhi. It means intelligence. When you are a nothing, when nothing confines you, when nothing defines you, when nothing contains you, when you are just an openness, then there is intelligence. Why? Because when you are nothing, fear disappears. And when fear disappears, you function intelligently. If fear is there, you cannot function intelligently. Fear cripples you, paralyzes you. You go on doing things because of fear. That's why you cannot become a Buddha, which is your birthright. You are virtuous because of fear. You go to the temple because of fear. You follow a certain ritual because of fear. You pray to God because of fear. And a man who lives through fear cannot be intelligent. Fear is poison to intelligence. How you can be intelligent if there is fear? The fear will go on pulling you into different ways. It will not allow you to be courageous. It will not allow you to step into the unknown. It will not allow you to become an adventurer. It will not allow you to leave the fold, the crowd. It will not allow you to become independent, free. It will keep you a slave. And we are slaves in so many ways. Our slavery is multidimensional, politically, spiritually, religiously. In every way we are slaves, and the fear is the root cause of it. You don't know whether God exists or not, and still you pray. This is very unintelligent. This is foolish. To whom you are praying? You don't know whether God is or not. You don't have any trust, because how can you have any trust you have not known yet? So just out of fear you go on clinging to the idea of God. Have you watched it? When there is much fear, you remember God more. When somebody is dying, you start remembering. I have known a follower of J. Krishnamurti, a very renowned scholar he is, known all over the country. And for at least 40 years he has been a Krishnamurti follower. So he does not believe in God. He does not believe in meditation. He does not believe in prayer. Then one day it happened. He fell ill. He had a heart attack. By chance I was in the same town. His son phoned me and said, my father is in a very dangerous situation. If you can come, it will be a great solace to him. These may be his last moments. So I rushed. When I went into the room, he was lying down on the bed with closed eyes, chanting Rama, Rama, Rama. I could not believe. For 40 years, he has been saying there is no God, and I don't believe. And what happened to this old man? I shook him up and asked, what are you doing? He said, don't disturb me. Let me do what I want to do. But I said, this is so much against Krishnamurti. He said, forget about Krishnamurti. I am dying and you are talking about Krishnamurti. But what about your 40 years wasted? And you had never believed that a japa, a chanting can help or a prayer can help? He said, yes, that's true. I had never believed, but now I am facing death. There is great fear in me. Maybe, who knows, God is. And within minutes I will be encountering him. If he is not, then there is no problem. Nothing is lost by my repeating Rama, Rama. If he is, something is gained. At least I can say to him, at the last moment I had remembered you. Have you watched it? Whenever you are in misery, you start remembering God more. When you are in danger, you remember God. When you are happy and everything is going smoothly, you forget all about God. Your God is nothing but your fear projected. Buddha says, out of fear, there is no possibility of intelligence. And fear is there for a very fundamental reason. Because you think you are, that's why there is fear. The ego brings fear as a shadow. The ego itself is illusory, but the illusion casts a big shadow on your life. Because you think I am, hence there is fear. Maybe if I do something wrong, I will be thrown in hell. Then I will suffer. If you think I am, then naturally you think to make some provisions for the future life, for the other world, do something good, accumulate a little punya. You know, the name of this town, Pune, comes from punya, virtue. Accumulate a little virtue. Accumulate something in your account, in your bank balance, so you can show to God that, look, I have been really a good boy. I have done these things, fasted so many days, have never looked at anybody's woman with any evil eye, have never been a thief, have donated so much money to this temple and to that church. I was always behaving as I was expected to behave. One starts accumulating virtue just in case it is needed in the other world. But this is out of fear. Your good people, your bad people are all living out of fear. An intelligent person lives without fear. But to live without fear, you will have to come to see into the fact of your ego. If there is no ego, if I am not, then where fear can exist? Then I cannot be thrown into hell, because I am not in the first place. And I cannot be rewarded into heaven, because I am not in the first place. I am not only God is, so how I can be a sinner or a saint? If only God is, then what is there for me to fear? I am not born because I am not in the first place, and I will not be dying because I am not in the first place. So there is no birth, no death. I am not separate. I am one with this existence. As a wave, I may disappear, but as the ocean, I will live. And the ocean is the reality, the wave is just arbitrary. Nothingness knows no fear, no greed, no ambition, no violence. Nothingness knows no mediocrity, no stupidity, no idiocy. Nothingness knows no hell, no heaven. And because there is no fear, there is intelligence. This is one of the greatest statements to be remembered. Intelligence is when fear is not. Then action has a totally different quality. When you act out of your nothingness, the action has a totally different quality to it. It is divine. It is godly. Why? Because when you act out of nothingness, it is not a reaction. When you act out of nothingness, it is not a plan. When you act out of nothingness, it is not rehearsed. When you act out of nothingness, it is spontaneous. Then you live moment to moment. You are a nothingness. A situation arises and you respond to it. If you are an ego, you never respond. You always react. Let me explain to you. When you are an ego, you always react. For example, if you think you are a very, very good man, you think you are a saint. And then something happens. Somebody insults you. Now, will you be responding to this insult or reacting? If you think you are a saint, you will think thrice how to react, what to do, so you can save your sainthood too. Otherwise, this man can destroy just by insulting you. You cannot be spontaneous. You have to look back. You have to ponder over it. And time is passing. Even it may be a single moment, but time is passing. It cannot be spontaneous. It cannot be in the moment. And you act out of the past. You think that this is too much. If I become angry, and anger is coming. If I become angry, my sainthood will be lost. That is too much to pay for this. You start smiling. To save your sainthood, you smile. This smile is false. It is not coming from you. It is not coming from your heart. It is just there painted on the lips. It is pseudo. You are not smiling. It is only your mask that is smiling. You are deceiving. You are a hypocrite. You are pseudo. You are phony. But you have saved your sainthood. You acted out of the past. Out of your particular image and idea of your being. This was a reaction. The man of spontaneity does not react. He responds. What is the difference? Just he allows the situation to function over him. And he allows the response to come out, whatsoever it is. The man who lives out of past is predictable. And the man who lives moment to moment is unpredictable. And to be predictable is to be a thing. To be unpredictable is to be freedom. That is the dignity of man. The day you are unpredictable, nobody knows, not even you. Remember, not even you. If you know it already that what you will do, then it is no more response. You are already ready. It is rehearsed. For example, you are going for an interview. You rehearsal. You think what is going to be asked and how you are going to answer it. It happens every day. It is so clear cut. Every evening I see people. Both kinds of people are there. when somebody has come there, ready-made, has thought over what he is going to say to me, has prepared it already, the script is ready, he has just to replay it. He has decided everything what he is going to ask. And I can see the difficulty of the person. Because when he comes in front of me, when he sits by the side of me, it is a different situation. A change starts happening. The climate, the presence, his love for me, my love for him, others' presence, the trust that is there, very tangible, love that is flowing, a meditative state, and it is absolutely different than he was thinking before. Now, whatsoever he has prepared looks irrelevant. It does not fit. He becomes fidgety, restless, what to do? And he does not know how to act spontaneously, how to act out of this situation. He comes in front of me, but I see the phoniness of it. His question does not come from his heart. It is just from the throat. It has no depth. His voice has no depth. He himself is not certain whether he wants to ask it anymore or not. But he has prepared it maybe for days. So the mind goes on saying, ask it, you have prepared it. And he sees the irrelevance of it. Maybe it has been already answered. Maybe answering to somebody else, I have answered it. Maybe the very situation is such, his own mind has changed and it is no more meaningful. But he acts out of the past, that is reacting. It will look awkward. He feels embarrassed if he has nothing to ask. And he cannot cry because he is a phony person. And he cannot simply say hello. And he cannot say that I would like just to sit in front of you for 1 minute and I have nothing to say. He cannot act out of this moment. He cannot be here now. He feels embarrassed. He has to ask. Otherwise, what people will think? Then why in the first place you had asked for darshan if you have nothing to ask? So he asks. He is no more behind it. It is a rotten old question which has no more meaning. But he asks. And sometimes you may have watched to few people, I go on answering and take long time. And to few people, I answer in very short. Whenever I see that somebody is phony, his question is phony, is a prepared question, then it is meaningless to answer him. Just out of respect for him, I talk a little bit to him, but I am no more interested. And the phony questioner is also not interested in what I am saying, because he is no more interested even in his question. So how he can be interested in the answer? But there are other people. And by the phoniness disappears and sannyasins become more and more true, authentic. Then somebody simply sits there and laughs. That's what is coming in that moment. He does not feel embarrassed. He does not feel that it is out of place. It is not. The prepared script is out of place. Facing a nothingness, you have to be nothing. Only then there can be a meeting. Because only the similars can meet. Then there is great joy. Then there is great beauty. Then there is dialogue. Maybe not a single word is uttered, but there is dialogue. Sometimes somebody comes and simply sits and starts swaying. Closes his eyes, goes inwards. That is the way to come towards me. goes inside himself and simply jumps into me and allows me to jump into him. Or simply touches my feet. Or simply looks into my eyes. Or sometimes a great question also arises. But it is in the moment, then it is true. Then it has immense powers. Then it comes from your very deepest core. It has relevance. When you act out of nothingness, you respond. It is no more reaction. It has truth. It has validity in it. Authenticity. It is existential. It is immediate, spontaneous, simple, innocent. And this action does not create any karma. Remember, the word karma means action. A particular action. Not all actions create karma. Remember, Buddha lived after his enlightenment for 42 years. He was not all the time sitting under the Bodhi tree doing nothing. He did 1001 things, but karma is not created. He acted, but it is no more reaction, it is response. If you respond out of nothingness, it leaves no residue, it leaves no traces on you. Karma is not created. You remain free. You go on acting and you remain free. It is as if a bird flies into the sky, leaves no traces, no footprints. The man who lives in the sky of nothingness leaves no footprints, leaves no karma, no residue. His act is total. And when the act is total, it is finished. It is complete. And a complete act does not hang around you like a cloud. Only incomplete acts hang around you. Somebody insulted, you wanted to hit him, but you didn't hit. You saved your sainthood, you smile and bless the man and went home. Now it is going to be difficult. Now the whole night you will dream that you are hitting the man. You may even kill him in your dreams. For years it will hang around you. It is incomplete. Anything incomplete is dangerous. But when you are phony, everything becomes incomplete. You love a woman, but not enough to make it complete. Even while making love, you are not entirely there. Maybe you are still rehearsing. Maybe you have been reading sex manuals, which are available. Maybe you have been reading Vatsanas, Kama Sutras, or Master and Johnson, or Kinsey Report, and you have been learning how to make love, and you are ready, knowledgeable. Now this woman is just an opportunity to practice your knowledge. So you are practicing your knowledge, but it is going to be incomplete because you are not in it. And then it is unsatisfying. Then you feel frustrated. And the cause is your knowledge. Love is not something to be practiced. Life need not be practiced. Life has to be lived in utter innocence. Life is not a drama. You need not prepare. You need not go into a rehearsal for it. Let it come as it comes and be spontaneous. But how can you be spontaneous if the ego is there? Ego is a great actor. Ego is a great politician. Ego goes on manipulating you. The ego says, if you really want to act in a polished way, preparation is needed. If you really want to act in a cultured way, You have to rehearsal it. The ego is a performer. And because of this performer, you go on missing the joy, the celebration, the blessing of life. Buddha says, when action comes out of nothing, it creates no karma. Then it is so total that its very totality, and the circle is complete and finished. You never look backwards. Why you go on looking backwards? Because things are incomplete there. Whenever something is complete, you don't look back. It is finished. The full point has been achieved. There is nothing more to do about it. Act out of nothingness and your action is total. And the total action leaves no memory, no psychological memory, I mean. On the brain, the memory is left, but there is no psychological hang-up. And a man who has no hang-ups is my definition of a sannyasin. When the act is utterly complete, you are free of it. When the act is total, you slip out of it like a snake slips out of the old skin. The old skin is left behind. Only incomplete acts become karma. Remember it. But to have a complete act, it has to come out of nothingness. There are three levels of awareness. Awareness of the self, awareness of the world, and awareness of the intervening fantasy between the self and the world. Fritz Perls called this intermediate level the DMZ, demilitarized zone, and it functions to keep us from being totally in touch with ourselves and our world. The DMZ contains our prejudices, the prejudgments through which we view the world and the other people and ourselves. If we look at the world through our biases, we cannot see the truth of it. We cannot see that which is. We create an illusion. That's what Hindus call Maya. If we look outside with judgments, a priori prejudices, then we create a world of our own, which is Maya, illusion, a projection. If we look through these judgments and knowledge and opinions at ourselves, we create another illusion, the ego. Then we cannot see what reality is there inside us. We cannot see what is there out, and we cannot see what is there in. When the outside is missed, we create illusion, Maya. When the inside is missed, we create the ego, ahankar. And both these things happen through DMZ, the demilitarized zone. Gurdjieff used to call this zone the zone of the buffers. DMZ is a beautiful name for it. The bigger the DMZ is, the more pathological is the person, more neurotic. The smaller the DMZ is, the more healthy, psychologically sane a person is. And when the DMZ completely disappears and there is no thought intervening between you and the world, not a single thought, that's what Buddha means by nothingness, then the person is utterly sane. Holy, whole. Before we enter into the sutra, few things about this ego, the illusion, of the self has to be understood. First thing, the ego is not a reality. It is just an idea. You don't come with it when you come into the world. You don't bring it with yourself. It is not part of your being. When a child is born, he does not bring the ego in the world. The ego is something that he learns. It is not part of genetics. Gordon Allport calls the self proprium, and it can be defined by considering the adjective form propriate, as in the word appropriate. Proprium refers to something that belongs to or is unique to a person. The self is created because each nothingness is unique. Each nothingness has its own way of flowering. Because of this uniqueness, the possibility of creating an ego. I love in my way, you love in your own way. I behave in my way, you behave in your own way. There is a difference between people, but only difference. The rose flower flowers in one way and the marigold in another. But both flower, the flowering is the same. The nothingness is the same. But each nothingness functions in a unique way. Because of this, there is a possibility to create the ego. There are 7 doors from where the ego enters in. 7 doors from where we learn the ego. Those doors have to be understood. Because if you understand them, you will be able to drop the ego. Because those doors, understood perfectly well, can be closed. Then the ego is created no more. Seen rightly, understood perfectly well that the ego is just a shadow, it starts disappearing on its own. The first door, Allport calls the bodily self. We are not born with a sense of self. The child in the mother's womb has no sense of the self. He is one with the mother. He is utterly one, joined, bridged with the mother. And the mother is his whole existence, his cosmos. He does not know that he is separate. The separation comes when the child comes out of the womb. And when his bridge with the mother is cut. And the child has to breathe on its own. In fact, the breathing is not something that the child is going to do. How can he do? He cannot even breathe yet, so he is not yet there. The breathing happens. It is not that the child is doing it. It is in happening. It comes out of nothingness. The child starts breathing. Those few seconds are very, very valuable, critical, dangerous. The parents, the doctor, the nurses who are looking after the birth, all are in a great waiting whether the child is going to breathe or not. The child cannot be forced, the child cannot be persuaded, and the child cannot do anything on its own. If it is going to happen, it is going to happen. It may not happen, it may happen. Sometimes children never breathe. Then we think they are born dead. It is miraculous how the child breathes the first breath. He has never done it before. He cannot be prepared for it. He does not know that the mechanism exists to breathe. The lungs have not functioned ever before. But the breath comes and the miracle starts. But the breath is coming out of nothingness, remember. Later on you will start saying that I am breathing. That is absurd. You are not breathing. Breathing is happening. Don't create the idea of I. Don't say I am breathing. Nobody is breathing. That is not within your capacity to do or not to do. You can try. Stop breathing for a few seconds and you will know that it is difficult to stop either. Within seconds, a grace rush from nowhere comes and you start breathing again. Or stop the breathing outside. Try for a few seconds and suddenly you see a great rush. It is beyond you. The breathing wants to come in. It is nothing that is breathing in you. Or you can call it God. It makes no difference. It is the same. Nothing or God, they mean the same. Nothing exactly means in Buddhism what God means in Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism. God is a nothing. We are not born with a sense of self. It is not part of our genetic endowment. The infant is not able to distinguish between self and the world around it. Even when the child has started breathing, it takes months for him to become aware that there is a distinction between his inside and the outside. Gradually, through increasing complex learning and perceptual experiences, a vague distinction develops between something in me and other things out there. This is the first door from where the ego enters. The distinction that something in me, for example, the child feels hunger. He can feel it coming from inside. And then the mother slaps the child and he can feel it is coming from the outside. Now a distinction is bound to be felt by and by, that there are things which come from inside and there are things which come from outside. When the mother smiles, he can see the smile is coming from there. And then he responds, he smiles. Now he can feel the smile is coming from within, somewhere inside. The idea of inside and outside arises. This is the first experience of the ego. In fact, there is no distinction between the outside and the inside. The inside is part of the outside and the outside is part of the inside. The sky inside your house and the sky outside your house are not two skies, remember. They are one sky. And so is the case. You there and I here are not two. We are two aspects of the same energy. Of two aspects of the same coin. But the child starts learning the ways of the ego. The second door is self-identity. The child learns its name, realizes that the reflection in the mirror today is of the same person as the one seen yesterday, and believes that the sense of me or self persists in the face of changing experiences. The child goes on knowing that everything changes. Sometimes he is hungry, sometimes he is not hungry, sometimes he is sleepy and sometimes he is awake, and sometimes he is angry and sometimes he is loving. Things go on changing. One day it is a beautiful day, another day it is dark and dismal. But he stands before the mirror. Have you watched a small baby sitting before a mirror? He tries to catch hold of the child inside the mirror because he thinks the child is outside there. If he cannot catch hold, then he goes around and looks at the back of the mirror, maybe the child is hiding there. But by and by, he starts knowing that it is he who is reflected. And then he starts feeling a kind of continuity. Yesterday also it was the same face. Today it is also the same face in the mirror. When for the first time children look into the mirror, they become fascinated with the mirror. They don't leave it. They go again and again to the bathroom to look who they are. Everything goes on changing. One thing seems to be unchanging, the self-image. The ego has another door from where it is entering, the self-image. The third door is self-esteem. This is concerned with the child's feeling of pride as a result of learning to do a thing on its own. Doing, exploring, making. When a child learns anything, for example, he has learned a word, daddy, then he goes on, daddy, daddy, the whole day. He does not miss a single opportunity when he can use the word. When the child starts learning to walk, he tries the whole day. He falls again and again. He stumbles. He is hurt. But again he stands. Because it gives a pride that I can also do something. I can walk. I can talk. I can carry things from here to there. The parents are very much worried because the child is a disturbance. He starts carrying things. They can't understand that why, for what, why you have taken that book from there. The child is not interested in the book at all. It is all nonsense for him. He cannot conceive why you go on looking in this thing continuously. What you are searching there. But his interest is different. He can carry a thing. The child starts killing animals, an ant, and he will jump on it and kill it. He can do something. He is enjoying doing. He can become very destructive. If he finds the clock, he will open it. He wants to know what is inside. He becomes an explorer, inquirer. He enjoys doing things because that gives a third door to his ego. He feels proud, he can do. He can sing a song, then he is ready to sing the song to anybody. Come any guest and he is present there waiting somebody to give a hint so he can do the song. Or he can dance. Or he can do a mimicry or something, whatsoever it is. He wants to do something, to show that he is not just helpless, that he can also do. This doing brings ego in. Fourth is self-extension, belonging, possession. The child speaks of my house, my father, my mother, my school. He starts increasing the field of mine. Mind becomes his key word. If you take his toy, he is not interested much in the toy. He is much interested that the toy is mine. You cannot take it. Remember, he is not interested much in the toy. When nobody is interested, he will throw the toy in the corner and will escape to play outside. But once somebody wants to take it, he does not want to give it. It is his mind. Mind gives a sense of me. Me creates I. And remember, these doors are not only for children, they remain your whole life that way. When you say my house, you are being childish. When you say my wife, you are being childish. When you say my religion, you are being childish. When a Hindu starts fighting with the Mohammedan for the religion, they are children. They don't know what they are doing. They have not really become mature and grown up. Children are constantly arguing that my daddy is the greatest daddy in the world. And so the priests go on fighting that my concept of God is the best, the most powerful, the real. Others are just so-so. These are very childish attitudes, but they linger around you your whole life. You are very much interested in your name. When I change people's name, few people are very stubborn, they don't want. Few people write letters to me that I want to take sannyas, but please don't change my name. Why? My name seems to be something like a great wealth, and there is nothing in the name. But for 30 years, 40 years, your ego has survived with that name. It is very difficult for the ego to close a door. That's why the name is changed, so that you can see that name is arbitrary. It can be changed any day. And that's why I change your name without any fuss about it. In other religions, name is also changed. If you become a Jaina monk, they will make much fuss about it. A great procession and celebration. Somebody is becoming a monk. No, he will become very much attached with this new name. So much celebration and so much festivity and so much honor and respect, so much fuss about it. Then the whole point is lost. I simply change it as a matter of fact. Just to give you an idea that it is nothing, it is arbitrary, it can be changed very easily. You can be called A, you can be called B, you can be called C, it doesn't matter. In fact, you are nameless. That's why it doesn't matter. Any name will do. It is only utilitarian. The fifth door is self-image. This refers how the child sees himself through interaction with parents, through praise and punishments. He learns to have a certain image of himself, good or bad. The child is always looking how the parents react to him. If he is doing a certain thing, they praise it or they punish him. If he feels punished, he thinks, I have done something wrong. I am bad. If he does something good and is praised, he thinks, I am good. I am appreciated. He starts trying to do more and more good, so that he is appreciated. Or if the parents are really very difficult and impossible people and their demands are such that the child cannot fulfill, then he takes the other route. He starts doing all that they call bad. He reacts and rebels. These are the two ways. The door is the same. Either you praise him and he feels good that he is somebody, or if you don't praise him easily, then he says, okay, then I will show you. Then also he will make his presence felt. He will start destroying things, he will start smoking, he will start doing things which you don't like. And he will say, now you see, you have to take my note. You have to notice me. You have to know that I am somebody and I am here. And you cannot just neglect me. The good guy and the bad guy are born this way, the saint and the sinner. The sixth, self as reason. The child learns ways of reason, logic, arguments. He learns that he can solve problems. Reason becomes a great support to his self. That's why people argue. That's why educated people think they are somebody's. Uneducated, and you feel a little embarrassed. You have a great degree, you are a PhD or a D.Litt, and you go on showing, exhibiting your certificate. you are a gold medalist, you have topped the university and this and that. Why? Because you are showing that I have become a rational being, well-educated in the best of the universities, educated by the best of the professors. I can argue better than anybody else. Reason becomes a great support. And the seventh, appropriate striving. Life, goal, ambition, becoming. What and who one is through what or who one wants to become. Future concern. Dreams and long-range goals appear. The last stage of the ego. Then one starts thinking what to do in the world to leave a mark in the history, to leave the signatures here on the sands of time, to become a poet, to become a politician, to become a Mahatma, to do this or to do that. And life is running fast, is slipping fast, and one has to do something, otherwise soon one will become nothing. And nobody will ever know that you had existed. One wants to become an Alexander or a Napoleon. If it is possible, one wants to become a good guy, famous, well-known, a saint, a Mahatma. If it is not possible, then too one wants to become somebody. Many murderers have confessed in the courts that they had not murdered somebody because they were interested in murdering him, but just they wanted their names on the front page of the newspapers. A man murdered somebody from the back. He came and snapped him. And he has not even seen the man before. It was absolutely unknown to him. They were not acquainted. There was no friendship, no enmity. He had never met. And this time also, he had not seen his face. Whom he has murdered, he has not seen him. He simply murdered him from the back. The man was sitting on the beach looking at the waves. And this man comes and kills him. The court was puzzled. But the man said, I was not interested in the man himself whom I killed. It was irrelevant. Anybody would have done. I had gone there to kill somebody. If this man was not there, then anybody else. But why? And he said, because I wanted my photo and my name on the front page of the newspapers. My desire is fulfilled. I am talked all over the country. I am happy. Now I am ready to die. If you sentence me to death, I can die happily. I was known. I was famous. If you cannot become famous, you try to become notorious. If you cannot become Mahatma Gandhi, you would like to become Adolf Hitler. But nobody wants to remain a nobody. These are the seven doors through which the illusion of the ego strengthens, becomes strong and strong. And these are the seven doors, if you understand, the ego has to be sent out again. Slowly, slowly, from each door, you have to look deep into your ego and say goodbye to it. Then arises nothingness, the sutra. Therefore, O Sariputra, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, nor perception, nor impulse, nor consciousness. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no forms, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or objects of mind, no sight, organ, element, and so forth, until we come to no mind, consciousness, element, there is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so forth, until we come to there is no decay and death, no extinction of decay and death. There is no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path. There is no cognition, no attainment, and no non-attainment. a tremendously revolutionary statement. Therefore, O Sariputra, first we have to understand the word therefore. Therefore is perfectly relevant in a syllogism, in a logical argument. There has been no argument preceding it. And Buddha says, therefore, O Sariputra. Scholars have been much worried why he uses therefore. Therefore is part of a syllogism. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is a martyr. It is part of logic. There has been no proposition, no argumentation. And suddenly Buddha says, therefore, why? The scholars cannot understand it. Because there has been no argument on the surface. But there has been a dialogue between the eyes of Buddha and Sariputra. There has arisen an understanding. Listening to Buddha, talking about emptiness, nothingness, Sariputra has arisen to that level of nothingness. It can arise in you here. You can feel it, its wings fluttering around you. Buddha says to Sariputra, looking into his eyes, Buddha feels, sees that Sariputra has understood. Now the argument can go further. On the surface there have been no argument, there have been no debate, discussion, but there have been a dialogue. The dialogue is between these two energies, Buddha and Sariputra. There has been a unity, they have been bridged. In that bridge, in that moment of bridging, Sariputra has looked into Buddha's emptiness. Now Buddha says, therefore, you have looked, Sariputra, now I can go further into it, into more details. Now I can say few things to you which would not have been possible before. Therefore, O Sariputra, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, nor perception. Because there is nobody to feel. So how can there be feeling? When the ego is not there, there is no feeling, no knowledge, no perception. No form arises because the sky is completely cloudless. You can see a form in a cloud. Have you not watched sometimes? A cloud looks just like an elephant, and then it changes into a horse, and then into something else, and it goes on changing. It takes so many forms. But have you ever seen any form arising in the pure sky? No form ever arises. There is no form, nor feeling, nor perception, nor impulse. And when there is nobody inside, how impulse can arise? How desire can arise? And nor consciousness. When there is no content, when there is no object, the subject also disappears. That consciousness which is always of the object is no more found there. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. Buddha says everything disappears into that nothingness, Sariputra. And now you can understand, Sariputra. Therefore I am saying, you have seen it. You have looked into me. You have been on the very verge of it. You have peeped into the abyss, the eternal, the abysmal depth. No forms, sounds, smell, taste, touchables are objects of mind. No sight, organ, element, and so forth. No mind, consciousness, element. When you are in that state, You cannot even say that I am in this state of nothingness. Because if you say this, you have come back. Until we come to. If you say I have experienced nothingness, that means you have come back to the world of form. The mind has started functioning again. In that moment, you are not separate from nothingness. So how you can say I am experiencing nothingness? Nothingness is not like an object. It is not separate from you. You are not separate from it. The observer is the observed there. The object is the subject there. The duality has disappeared. There is no ignorance, Buddha says. There is no knowledge. There is no ignorance either. Because ignorance can only be when you think in terms of knowledge. It is comparison with knowledge. When you call a man ignorant, what do you mean? You are comparing him with somebody who is knowledgeable. But there is no knowledge, so there cannot be any ignorance. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance. And Buddha says, remember, I am not saying that ignorance disappears. Ignorance has never been there. It was a shadow of knowledge. It was a shadow of the mind addicted with knowledge. When you bring a light into a dark room, what do you say? Does the darkness disappear, goes out from the room, escapes from the room, runs away? No, you cannot say that. Because darkness does not exist in the first place. How can it go out? Light comes and darkness is not found. Because darkness was just the absence of light. So there is no ignorance and no extinction of ignorance. There is no knowledge and there is no non-knowledge. One simply is innocent of all knowledge, ignorance. Just innocent, virgin. To be free of knowledge and to be free of ignorance is to be virgin, to be pure. There is no decay and death because there is nobody to die. And remember, there is no extinction of decay and death. And Buddha is not saying that death disappears because death has never been there in the first place. To say that death has disappeared will be wrong. Buddha is very, very perfect in his assertion. Very careful. He has not uttered a single word which can be refuted by anybody who knows reality. He has not compromised. He has not compromised with the listener. He has said the most possibly perfect thing that can be said. There is no suffering. Now he comes to the ultimate revolutionary statement. You must have heard about the four noble truths of Buddha. The first noble truth is suffering, that everybody is suffering. That the whole existence is dukkha, suffering, pain, misery, agony. And the second noble truth is its origination is in craving, tanha, desire. Suffering exists, first noble truth, arya satta. Second noble truth, that suffering has a cause and the cause is in desire. We suffer because we desire. And the third noble truth, this desiring can be stopped. It is possible, nirodha. It can be stopped. By looking deep into desiring, it can be stopped. And when desiring stops, suffering disappears. And the fourth noble truth, there is an eightfold path that leads to the stoppage, nirodha, of desiring and consequently of suffering. This is Buddhism's most fundamental philosophy. And in this statement, Buddha denies that too. He says, there is no suffering, no origination, no stopping, and no path. Nobody has ever stated such a revolutionary thing. Buddha reaches to the uttermost peak of revolution. Everybody else falls short. Now, scholars have always been worried that this is contradictory. Buddha teaches that there is suffering, and then one day he says there is no suffering. He teaches that there is cause why suffering is, and then one day he says there is no origination. He teaches that there is a possibility, nirodha, it can be stopped, and one day he says there is no stopping. And he says, and his whole Buddhism depends on that saying, that there is an eightfold path, astangic marga, right vision, right exercise, right meditation, right samadhi, so on and so forth. Eight-limbed path which leads you to the ultimate truth. And now one day he says there is no path. The reality is a pathless reality. Why this contradiction? The first statement is made to those who does not know that they are not. The first statements are made to ordinary people, full of egos. This statement is made to Sariputra in a particular space, in a particular state. Therefore, O Sariputra, now I can say to you, I could not have said it before. You were not ready. Now you have looked into me, and looking into me, you have seen what nothingness is. You have had a taste of it. Therefore, Sariputra, tasmak Sariputra, up now it is possible to say to you that there is no suffering, that is a dream. People are suffering in dream, and there is no causation. People are desiring in dream, and there is no stopping. People are exercising, doing methods, meditating, yoga, etc., in dream. And the whole path exists in the dream. Now it can be said to you because you are awake, Sariputra. Your eyes are opened. Now you see the ego does not exist. And to get out of the ego is to get out of sleep. To get out of the ego is to get out of darkness. To get out of the ego is to be free. In that freedom it can be said that there is no path. It is like a dream. In dream you are suffering. And when you are suffering in a dream, it is so real. And you are searching, why I am suffering? And then you come across a great sage in dream. And the sage says, you are suffering because you are desiring. You are so much infatuated with money, that's why you are suffering. You drop this desire and the suffering will disappear. You understand it, it is very logical. You know it, you have experienced yourself that whenever you desire, suffering comes. The more desire is there, the more suffering. The greater the desire, the bigger the suffering. You understand it. Then you ask, then how to stop it? And the great sage says, you stand on your head. You do yoga. You do chaotic meditation. You do kundalini. You do nada brahma. You do encounter group, and you do Leela, and you do primal therapy and all. And the great sage says, you do these things. These will help. You will become more understanding of your desire, and you will be able to drop the desire. So, the sage gives you a well-formulated eightfold path. He says, this is the way. One day, when you will really be awake, and remember, these things help you to awake. Now, even if you stand on your head in a dream, there is a possibility your dream will be broken. Try. Tonight, try. When you are in a dream, just stand on your head in the dream and suddenly you will say you are awake. Do kundalini in a dream. You will be awake, and if you are not, at least your husband will be awake. Neighbors will be awake. Something is going to happen. All methods are just to wake you. But when you are awake, therefore Sariputra, and now Buddha can say this to Sariputra, he is awake. He can say, now I can tell you the truth. That nobody exists, neither the disciple, nor the master, nor the dream, nor the suffering, nor the sage, nor the cause, nor the stopping. There is no path. This is the ultimate statement of truth. But this can be made only at the highest stage, at the seventh rung of the ladder. Sariputra reached to that rung on this day. That's why, therefore, tasmak Sariputra. Enough for today.